Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
You just have to get my whole title.
Good morning. Welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning with financial planner Joe Sullender to talk about whatever Joe and Tammy want to talk about, but basically getting real about retirement. So, Joe, good morning.
Good morning.
And Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, GovExec, article writer. What is it, 40 people, Tammy? 40 money.
Oh, 40 money heroes. Yeah.
Heroin. All right.
I guess so. I think Joe's the money hero. I'm just along for the ride.
All right. We got a hero and a heroine and a bean counter. Anyway, we're here this morning to talk about getting real for retirement. We'll talk about interest rates affecting things like the voluntary contribution and something called FERS, R-E-A?
R-A-E.
R-A-E. But we should start off by saying, we're here. Give us a call, 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. It's 10:07 a.m. Monday the 17th of December, and we'll be here till about 10:58, same day. But if you're listening outside of that date, don't call us. We won't be here. We'll give you the email address in a while. But anyway, Joe, so let's get real. Let's start off towards the pre-retirement folks. You address it as well as Tammy and I. But what do you find that they're not real about or that you could tell them to get more real about? Oh, my God. We'll be on
for
3 days.
That's a good place to start. I think that the one question that most retirees have is they tend to be very conservative. It's a very big leap to go from having a paycheck to maybe not having a paycheck or a much smaller one. And the one thing that I find gets people ready to make that leap is when they really feel like they have a feel for what it is they're going to spend when they retire versus what they spend now. And so what I think the first step to really be having readiness for retirement is having a feel for what it is that you spend now. I don't think a lot of people know that. They just bring home money and they pay for things and it all works out. I tell people to do that first by not sitting down and writing up, here's what my car payment is, here's my phone bill, here's my cable bill. But just take what their take-home pay is and subtract what they're saving. And that gives them a feel for what it is that they're actually consuming. What are they using? And then they can make some mental adjustments if they want to spend a little more money on travel when they retire. Maybe their mortgage will be gone. They'll move somewhere cheaper. I mean, there's the mortgage, kids being grown, travel. These are the adjustments in retirement mainly from your spending now versus when you actually do retire. And if people track that for, say, 6 months, a year, they start to see, you know what? Maybe I'm spending like $6,000 a month, and then they can look at all their other factors where they might get the money and find that it's a lot more comfortable than they really thought it was. I think people tend to be a little more pessimistic and negative about it, and I think that helps them shore that up.
Are there templates that people can use to do this? A lot of people aren't necessarily money inclined or math inclined for that, but is there something easy to follow?
There's a lot of templates where you can fill in, here's what I spend on this, that, and the other. But honestly, I find that for me and for anybody who's not math inclined, that it's just as simple as replacing your take-home pay. You know, I mean, I find it not to make it that much more complicated.
Yeah, sources of income are pretty limited while you're working, right? You have a paycheck and maybe alimony.
If it's coming in and it's not being deposited in savings or something, then it's being spent. You know, I mean, and most people, it's a lot of work to figure out where did every $20 bill go.
I know a big interesting question that comes up in the seminars is what doesn't come out of my retirement check that does come out of my paycheck? So we talk about some of the withholdings that stop when you retire, for instance, the retirement contribution and the FICA tax and the Medicare tax and possibly the state income tax if you live in a state that doesn't tax retirement benefits or doesn't have a state income tax, because it seems like a lot of people think about moving after they retire, and so they have to learn about the tax issues wherever they're moving to.
And there's a really good quick view of that with NARF's Retirement Life publication. It's updated each year, usually March, sometimes April. But in the rearview mirror, you're looking at last year because nobody can give you an update until after the end of the year. And it shows a group of states that don't have state income tax. That people should move there because the best one is Alaska. And then they have below that states alphabetically. It's every other state in the country that has a special benefit. We could go on and on. Not that everybody's local, but we got Maryland, Virginia, D.C. Maryland has the best exclusion, but you have to know it, because if you don't claim it on your return,
you don't
you
get it.
Can be assured that the state is not going to write you mm-hmm. back and say, gee, you forgot to do this. But it's a nice guide. There are other, you know, guides that are more lengthy, but this is a good, oh, I didn't know that. Let me read further.
Yeah, that's NARF, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. That's NARFE.org if you're looking for them.
Okay.
Plus, they're going to revamp their magazine next month. So I'm real interested to see like the update for the NARF organization. I think that'll be a good thing.
One thing to bring up, though, that you both added here that I think is a great point is that you can see how this can become complicated and overwhelming to somebody, is that now they're thinking, well, wait, what's taken out of this check? What's taken out of that? And what state tax and this? That's why the way I try to do it is make it a little simpler. And if you do it on a net basis, then you have your net paycheck, regardless of what was taken out prior to it. And then you have your net estimate from OPM or your HR department. The only thing that doesn't include, that retirement estimate, is, of course, state taxes, which you've talked about, where you can get information on that. So I think, just in my experience, the simpler, the better. People mm-hmm. feel kind of overwhelmed trying to go, now, what am I paying in payroll tax? And what am I paying, you know, and all these other things.
Yeah, the other checks, though, you might be getting a Social Security check and
that's
maybe withdraw from your TSP. So count all of your sources of income. And I think
on
that's
a net
right.
basis.
On a
I
net
think
basis, yeah. And out of your Social Security check, you might have tax withholding, maybe Medicare Part B, and out of your thrift plan, taxes.
Right.
So the only one that's going to have other withholdings would be the one from OPM, which would be your insurance, health benefits, life insurance, dental, vision.
Okay. Joe, when you talk about taking money out of the TSP. Mm-hmm. Is there a rule of thumb? I've heard 3%, I've heard 4%, I've heard 5%. If you have X dollars in the TSP, or any investment for that matter, but mm-hmm. certainly the TSP.
How can you
for
estimate the income mm-hmm. from this?
Yeah, and is there a, I suppose a safe number would be 1 or 2%, but I mean, is there a safe number at 3 or 4?
I think 3 is reasonable. I mean, I don't know that I want people basing their retirement on just that. That's sort of a back of the cocktail napkin kind of calculation, you know, where you just go 3. But a 3 to 4% number, I think, is a reasonable way to kind of eyeball it. But I do think that people should sit down and do a little more concrete math to that, you know, and see. There's certainly software and things people can get their hands on if they have a financial planner or somebody they work with that will take into account the volatility of the market and how they have the money invested related to what they're going to be withdrawing. Yeah, I mean, that's a big factor, because what happens if you retire and you have the money aggressively invested and the market struggles?
Okay, yeah. Being a financial planner, and you are a financial planner, and how mm-hmm. could somebody contact you?
Oh, good question, Bob. they can reach me. Email is usually the easiest. My email is joseph.sullender, and that's S-U-L-L-E-N-D-E-R, at wellsfargoadvisors.com.
One more time.
All right, let me try again. joseph.sullender, and that's S-U-L-L-E-N-D-E-R, at wellsfargoadvisors.com.
Okay. So, and Wells Fargo, I'm sure you've got programs upon programs upon programs to make these calculations and simulations and the like. But sometimes I get into class, and of course I'm not a financial planner, but somebody will say, well, the financial planner said we could take 5% out. And I said, probably not in this class. I guess if
it wasn't me, Bob.
No, I know that. I don't think it would be anybody else. But in other words, it could be a greater percentage taken out. Not, again, like you say, this is not a rule of thumb for everybody. But I suppose the older you are, the greater the percent is that you can take out. And the younger you are, the lesser percent you can take out.
And it depends on if you're trying to spend down the principal. Some people have the attitude of wanting to have estate goals. They want or need to leave some money behind to beneficiaries or family or whatever it may be. So that would play a role too, is what your goal is. Do you want to spend your last, you know, as some clients say, do I want to bounce my last check, or do you want to leave some money behind and have that cushion?
Okay, and sometimes that gets into Roth conversions. And we talk about Roth conversions in class, all three of us, and people say, well, I'd have to pay the tax up front, but that's good because then I can leave it behind for my heirs and they'll have tax-free income for life. Well, maybe they will. Maybe they won't, because depending on the age of the heirs, but somebody's got to pay tax on that up front. And doing that calculation is interesting. It usually stops with you have to write a 4-digit check And they go, I don't think so.
But surprisingly, I find in the seminars makes more sense than people think it does, because there are a great deal of federal retirees that can live predominantly off of their retirement checks. And if that's the case, I don't mean every penny. Some do. Some need a little supplement. But if you're barely using these assets, when you run this forecast to see where your money will grow to, you'll see that you may not ever touch this money. In fact, until you're required to, of course, at 70 and a half, they make you start making these withdrawals. But that people run these forecasts and find they're going to leave this money to their kids. You could, instead of leaving them seven figures, all taxable to the children if they withdraw it, you could pay a much smaller check, even still a big one, but a smaller check, to be able to leave that money to the children and not be required to make withdrawals during your lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, so it really, I think, is much more useful than people give it credit for. And when people see that big tax number, you're right. I mean, it's hard to even as a financial planner, to tell somebody, here's what I want you to do. I want you to pay the government $85,000, you know, or whatever it comes to.
Sure, but, Joe.
But, okay, we'll sign up for that. But it's one of those long-term things that I think makes some sense.
Have you found a lot of chatter with regards to this coming to the potential, well, whatever you want to call the cliff, tax rates are going up next year? For some people at a minimum, and mm-hmm. a lot of people maybe at a maximum. So people say, well, I'd like to convert my traditional IRA before the end of the year when the tax rates are lower. Do you get much of that?
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, not even just the fiscal cliff, but I think even whether they solve this tomorrow or 6 months from now, I think the general consensus, which I tend to agree with, I don't always agree with the general consensus here, but I do on this case, is that our income tax rates will rise. And, you know, people try to say, well, will I be in a lower bracket when I retire? You can kind of predict some of that, but then some of it you can't, because it's all judged by what the government decides on a year-to-year basis.
In a sense, I hope they're not in a lower bracket when they retire.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to say, because a lot of federal retirees I've seen have incomes in retirement that are very generous, mm-hmm. and that if you have that kind of income, you're going to pay some tax on it.
And that brings to mind something, Tammy, that I hear all the time is you hear this general rule that when you retire, you're going to be in a lower bracket. There's so much of the mass media that talks about financial planning that is not really talking about a federal retiree.
Right.
And I talk to my seminar people all the time, and my clients as well, about that, about, you know, just because you hear on TV or radio that you're going to be in a lower tax bracket when you retire, may not be the case.
I'm not so sure they are, because if you look at it on a graph and somebody retires and you look at the income line, you would hope that it would rise over time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at your tax deduction line, it's going in reverse. Mm-hmm. It's going
down.
That's true. Houses probably paid down. State and local income taxes probably are less. Hopefully medical expenses aren't more, but the threshold for doing that is going to be really hard to so really, you got a divergence of the two lines, which means it creates a greater taxable income. Now, I'm not trying to put people to sleep with this, but the idea that you're guaranteed to be in a lower bracket because the income is lower, I'm not so sure.
And plus, what do we think is going to happen as our government policy? I mean, you know, when you see the deficit and debts and you see our tax rates historically for our country and you see our tax rates relative to the other developed nations around the world, the writing is kind of on the wall that I think that, and you're the tax guy, Bob, I don't know if you have your crystal ball with you or not, but that tax rates, I'll say this, I don't think they decline dramatically over the next 30, 40 years.
No, looking backwards 43 years, when I first started, they were 70% and 80%.
People forget that.
Income. And plus the state. And I mean, these people had to make a lot of money.
We even look at some countries around the world today, like in countries in Europe, their tax rates much higher than mm-hmm. what ours are here in the U.S. So a lot of that's connected to services like healthcare and mm-hmm. care for the elderly. But, you know, we have to collect taxes to pay for those services.
And I don't want to, not the point of the three of us here, I don't think, is to scare the heck out of everyone and think that but to make an assumption that tax rates are going to be much lower later in your life, that's what I would caution against. And when if you take that assumption away and you look at maybe not using your TSP very heavily when you retire, then the Roth conversion starts to look like a brilliant idea.
Yeah. Roth TSP, of course, is you got to pay me now or pay me later. In that case, you pay me now, right? So pre-retirees, while they're on the job doing the Roth, it's going to be expensive for them tax-wise because they not only have the feds, but they got the state bracket. the investments, if correct me if I'm wrong, Tammy, they mirror each other. So, right, Joe? Mm-hmm. So if a dollar goes into the Roth TSP, it gets split as if it went into the traditional TSP in the allocation of the investment, right?
Well, when you contribute to the Roth TSP, you can allocate everything to go to Roth, but the government contribution has to go to the traditional.
I think what Bob's asking, though, is the investments. If I've got it 50% C, 50% G, and I in the regular TSP, and I start contributing to the Roth, will it have the same allocation investment-wise?
I think it does.
Yeah,
it does.
They mirror each other.
They do, yeah. It's just a tax treatment of the two assets.
Right. And the same when you
accounts.
Withdraw the money. If you're going to take $100 a month out of your TSP and you have some of it in the Roth and some of it in traditional, you can't allocate just to come out of the traditional. It's going to come out pro rata out of
Is that something
both.
They're thinking of adding or changing? Have you heard
I think
anything?
Down the road, I think just that for simplicity's sake, till they get this thing rolling and get the mechanics of it started, that's limiting to that.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have them on the show, what, in January?
January 7th.
TSP director and
I might call
public
in.
Affairs.
I have a
yeah.
few questions.
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting show. An interesting show.
All right. What else perplexes people, Joe, with regards to retirement? I like the way you look at it. Let's look at it the other way around. Instead of all the moving parts, what do you take home? What do you spend? What do you have left? Or what are you racking up in credit cards or debt? And will that stop? Mm-hmm. But how do you get them to face the ones that really can't make it? In other words, they're spending more than what they're bringing home. What do you do to work with them to
Good
cut?
Question.
Oh,
but
man.
You meet a lot of those these days.
You know, to be honest, I don't see as many of those. And I think maybe some of it might be just because of,
they're not calling
they're not
you.
Gonna come talk to me. They don't want to hear
no,
hear
they know what you're gonna tell them.
They do. They duck out the back door of the seminar. The biggest thing is if you're I'll make this real simple. If you're spending more than you are bringing home, you have a 5-alarm fire to put out. I mean, this goes nowhere, you know. I mean, and I know I'm not making any sort of political commentary here. I'm talking about personal spending. Mm-hmm. If you're spending more than you're bringing home, you've got to stop it. And the only way I've found to do it is you've got to have a budget. You have to have some sort of way on a monthly basis to not only monitor what you spend, but to control it and get it under control. I mean, most people spend more than they're making just because they don't plan for that 2 weeks or that month or whatever, you know, the time frame they're looking at. And that is something that I think there are great templates out there where you can fill in, here's what I spend on each category. Mm-hmm. You just have to cut something.
Okay.
Boy, I don't want to.
You have less, you'll no. spend less, but that doesn't always hold
but
true.
If you catch them early enough, mid-career folks sometimes,
yes.
I think, get frustrated because the beginning career, I could sit and talk about this all day long, you and any one of the three of us, and they kind of look at you and go, no, I just got out of high school. I've never had it. Now I got a job. I just got out of college. I got debt, but I want a car. I want to rock mm-hmm. and roll. I don't want to save. Well, you kind of have to put your foot in the water, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're not going to save as much now, but you can't keep that up.
The great thing about doing seminars for people early in their careers is you catch them early in the mentality. I mean, the difficult part is to spend at a certain level and then go down in lifestyle. If you start out from day one saving a portion of what you spend, it becomes, you know, then
habit.
Every time you get a raise or every time more money comes in, you can spend a little more. But it's tough to take somebody who's 50, who's starting to get serious about retirement, mm-hmm. who's spending way too much money.
Or who hasn't done anything about retirement by age 50, and you tell them you have to save, you know, a good portion of your salary, and they don't know how to do it because they're spending everything they're bringing in.
Right, exactly.
It makes it tough.
Yep.
Okay, now we got the people, they're all intent on savings. What do we invest in?
Well, first you look at the vehicles before you look at the investments. And what I mean by that is you take advantage of all the places that give you tax breaks. And the TSP is certainly the first on that list. If you're saving for retirement, that's what I assume we're talking about. So if you save for retirement, you start with the TSP. Obviously, if you're saving for education, there's things like 529 plans and other vehicles. But I think it begins there. And then if you have more money you want to save, then you can start looking at IRAs and Roth IRAs. I mean, the good news is there's a lot of vehicles out there that allow you to do this in a much more tax-efficient way than just putting the money in an account somewhere and getting taxed while you're trying to build it.
One of the things I tell people is that the younger you start saving, the less you have to save. Because if you're mm-hmm. right coming into the government right out of school and you save 5% and you do that for the next 30 or 40 years, that might be all you really need to do to be able to retire.
Yep.
And but if you're 50 and just starting to save, 5% is not going to cut it, I don't think.
That's true. And I tell you, Tammy's so right in that I see so many people that are, say, 50 that have been saving since the beginning, and they want to know when they can afford to retire. And I run the math, and they're overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks great. Yeah. Like, they can do it because they've accumulated so much, you know, early on, that they're really sitting a lot better at 50 than they thought. And those are probably the people calling me.
The one thing that that FERS did for employees is they put fear in employees. That they knew that they were responsible for their retirement, unlike CSRS that could just work 30 or 40 years and mm-hmm. retire. That I think FERS made people really think about saving from the beginning. So I do meet a lot of employees who have been doing it consistently since 1987 when the thrift plan started.
I mean, I actually would say over 3/4 of the forecast I do for people find out good news. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, it's, and I think some of it is the pessimism in our country and in the media.
Yeah.
You know, I think that in general, they think that they're no way they're ever going to be able to retire. But if you've been putting money in from the beginning,
And encouragingly, I find a lot of employees who leave, at least after the first, I don't know what happens when they get to you, Joe, but after the first day of the seminar, they feel encouraged. They're like, wow, yeah, I didn't realize I had, you know, all of this to draw from. So they're pleasantly surprised in many cases, which is nice.
I think this begs the reason for why, have a financial plan. Mm-hmm. I mean, run the math before you are spending your weekends slumped shoulders thinking, I'm never, ever going to be able to do this. Let's put pen to paper and see how it looks. And it's kind of nice, this environment, in that it stinks that it's a very negative vibe that a lot of folks have about money and the future and whatever. But it's very positive for me in my practice because I get to pleasantly surprise everyone.
Okay. When you're modeling with somebody, let's take somebody 50-ish, 50, and they're starting to get serious about it. But they're not going to get there if they're going to retire at 60 in a very cautious environment. Now, how do you move them away from the G fund or the F fund? You'll probably look at me like I've lost my mind. But
No,
their fund probably is. Let's not get into that. But
yeah, one thing I'd say about that is I think people are surprised when they talk to me that I'm not necessarily trying to move them away from the G and the F fund. The way I look at it, I mean, even though I feel like over a long period of time you can make more money, it's about your goals. If you can meet your goals being in the G or the F fund, then stay in the G or the F fund. Why would you be more aggressive? I don't care if you're 30 years old. You know, if you can meet your goals that way, that's what you should do. And so that's why I think the pen to paper plan makes sense, to be able to figure out if you can meet your goals being in the G fund. Well, good for you. Now you don't have to worry about all this nonsense.
What do you tell people about the life cycle funds?
The life cycle funds, I think I still tell you two answers. One is what they're really, really good for is a default for people that this is a foreign language to, mm-hmm. you know, and I can respect it. I do this for a living. You know, this is what I'm into. You know, a lot of people, they see this and go, I don't even know, CGF makes no sense. So the L funds, are a good place for that. I don't use them in my practice, and anybody that wants a more sophisticated, in-depth, customized plan, I'm not a fan of them for, right. Because they assume that just because you're retiring in 2020, let's say, that you should be in the L2020. And I've done this long enough to know that there's lots of people retiring in 2020 with lots of different situations,
yeah.
you know.
Yep.
And so I tend to like the more customized plan, but it's kind of like I use the analogy at the deli at the grocery store. You know, you go in there, they have the prepackaged meals that you can take home for people like me that cooking is a foreign language, you know, but you might, you know, feel more comfortable building your own ingredients and mm-hmm. taking something that fits you. So that's sort of the way I position the alpha.
How do you educate the person that it is a foreign language? I mean, you can't get them to be fluent in mm-hmm. what you do,
sure.
But how do you get them just to take one step forward?
Really by making it simple. I mean, you just, as long as you keep it simple, that's why, I mean, we can get into, when you talk about this stuff, the real intricacies of it. And sure, your plan will be better if you've worked out all of the intricacies, but we can also do this in a very simplistic way. To make somebody feel comfortable about it and be sure they're going to meet their goals. Of course, if they want it more customized, there's obviously people like me and lots of resources out there. I mean, one of the great things about today's society financially, I think, is there's lots of good financial planners and professionals, but there's even a lot of good places you can go if you want to do all this on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of resources and things that you can read and find out about, and it's all out there. It's just a matter of taking advantage of it.
Could I take a segue over to Tammy? Because you just really hit on something Tammy sure. brought today. Social Security books. Yes. I mean, Social Security yeah. is a source
it's,
of
It's a
of
big
income.
Source of income for a lot of people.
And the variables.
Unfortunately, it's a big source of income as far as the percentage it plays in somebody's retirement. For someone who doesn't have a pension, who didn't save a lot, Social Security could represent more than half of their retirement income. And considering that the average check is less than $1,200 a month, that's not very encouraging. But on the other hand, employees who have a pension, who have savings, and who also have paid into Social Security, like our FERS employees, they may have some flexibility as to deciding when to take their Social Security, whether they do it at 62, the day they become eligible, whether they wait to their full retirement age, somewhere closer to 66 or 67, or some people will wait till they're 70, either because they're still working or because they've had the luxury of waiting because they have other sources of income. So there are, starting with Social Security's website, ssa.gov has a whole fact sheet on their webpage about when's the best time to take, or what should you think about, I should say, when to take Social Security. Look at your life expectancy, look at your family history. Look where else you would get the money from that you would need to support yourself in retirement. Consider the fact that if you're 62 and still in good health, you can have a part-time job to make up what Social Security would give you from 62 to 66, might let you wait. And if that's not enough, there are multiple books out there. I have at least three or four of them on claiming strategies of when to take Social Security. All you got to do is go to Amazon.com and put Social Security in there and you'll see them come
up. Is there a consensus in the books? I mean, to, you know, I generally tend to say, take it when you need it.
Right.
You know, do they say the same thing or is it all over the place?
It boils down to one simple question, which nobody hopefully can answer.
When are you going to die?
When are you going to die? Yeah. No, I mean, the one book fine tunes it to the point, if you know you're going to die between 77 and 80, here's what you should do. And if you're going to live to be 83, well, we've got another plan for you. But aside from that, it's basically, am I still working?
Right.
Do I need the money? And then how long am I going to live? And if you can come close to answering those three questions, you'll
at least get the first couple.
At least
down.
The first two might be doable. The last one's a good guess.
I was reading, and I can't remember what magazine it was, and it was a married couple, and the one qualified for Social Security but didn't take it based on their income. They took it based on their spouse's mm-hmm. income. And it was an interesting formula, but at the end of the article, this all is dependent upon life expectancy.
Yeah, but that's a good point, Bob, because if you are part of a married couple and you're fairly close in age, or even if you're not, but if you're fairly close in age, there's a real argument for waiting until you reach your full retirement age. Because in the full retirement ages, we used to say 65, and now mm-hmm. it's like 66 or 67. But if you wait till that age, you have the option to delay your own Social Security benefit till maybe 70 and then take your spouse's benefit, which is 50% of what they've earned. And so you'll have that source of income to tide you over till you're 70. Then at 70, your benefit goes 132% of what it was at 66. And another thing that some couples do is that the one couple, maybe the higher wage earner, will file and suspend taking their benefit so that their spouse can start receiving benefits as early as 62 in some cases. And so there's a lot to do with strategies for married couples that really should be looked at and considered, because the difference between a benefit at age 62 and a benefit at age 70 is 76%. Mm-hmm. That's something. So right there is a huge source of income for someone who may not have
books.
Enough.
You mentioned books. Where do they, I mean, if someone were to call the Social Security mm-hmm. office and ask this question, is that the right way to go about this? You know what I mean? I mean,
well,
are they going to explain
that
to them?
If you sit down with someone at Social Security, they're not going to give advice because that, we government employees mm-hmm. don't give advice, but they can say, here's what you have available. Here's spousal benefits.
Options.
This is what happens if you wait. Here's your ex-spouse's benefit and so forth. But either you talk to a financial advisor like yourself who can kind of fit that into the overall financial plan, or if you're a do-it-yourselfer, there are books out there. You know, mm-hmm. one I have here is called Social Security Strategies. Another one's called a Social Security Owner's Manual. And there's multiple other ones out there that are written by financial people, you know, basically economists or financial advisors who have looked at these things and ran the numbers. But it's interesting. It's almost a science these days to figure out when to take Social Security.
Yeah. And just I have to say something about taxes. Social Security is extremely tax efficient. People, and when I tell them in class, they go, "What?" I said, "At the highest, it's 85% taxable." That's not an 85% tax.
So no.
If they get $1,000 a month, they pay tax on $850. And many states, not all, but many states, probably even could say most, don't tax Social Security. Mm-hmm. So tax wise, it's a really good deal.
And one more thing about Social Security that people worry about, because we do hear, you know, Social Security in the discussions of the fiscal cliff and just in general discussions in Congress. And you read on your statement, it says, you know, if nothing changes by 2033, you won't be getting the benefits that are promised. And so I think a lot of people take it early in fear that something's going to change. So what I have to say to that is any time in history when Congress has had to change Social Security rules, they've always grandfathered in the changes. So anybody who is anywhere near eligible for Social Security will probably not be greatly affected by those changes. Now, for instance, the 1983 amendments, if you were born before 1937, you weren't affected. And that would have been anybody who was 60 or 62 years old the year those.
So they're not going to only grandfather the people that are taking Social Security. That's the key point. They're going to grandfather everyone that is eligible.
You're close to being eligible.
So it's not like you have to be taking Social Security to avoid this.
Right. In fact, even President Obama has said if you were born in 1950, which you'd have been 62 this year, 1950 or earlier, don't worry about any changes we're going to make. You won't be affected. And that would be anybody who is currently eligible for a benefit. So I think that fear factor is overemphasized, which I think we shouldn't put as much fear in that.
I am living proof of this because I called Tammy up and I said, "Tammy, I'm eligible. Should I take it? Because I think they're going to change the law." And you talked me off the cliff.
You're safe.
Just exactly what you just said. They're not going to bother you because you're a geezer. she didn't say that. But
anyway. Did I? Okay.
And there's this. We were talking in before the show. What is this thing called? A chained consumer price index? Should I even say that?
Well, we've heard of this for years, and this is another one of those fear factors that are driving people to retire sooner than they maybe should. The COLA for retirees, the cost of living adjustment that retirees get, is based on the consumer price index. It's the one that's for clerical and urban wage earners, or whatever that one is, the CPIW. And there's a chain CPI, which is a different measurement of goods and services that is maybe a little less generous than the one we're currently using. So Congress is considering, and I have, you know, we've all seen that in the news, everybody's seen that, that they might switch to that for calculating COLAs for Social Security recipients, civil service and FERS retirees, and military retirees. That could happen. It could not happen. It depends. It's just something that's definitely on the table. And it could cause a less generous COLA, but any COLA is better than none. And a lot of private sector pensions get zero COLA. So you just have to factor that into your plan.
And to combat that, one thing that I do when I run people's plans is I do inflation at a higher rate than the COLAs on their retirement checks, just to build in that security.
So that it'd still be okay, even if it was less generous.
Even if there was, say, a percentage point gap between actual inflation. Because we've kind of had that a little bit. Even though real inflation is quite low, people in their personal lives are finding that things are more expensive, things like gas and other factors of living that don't always factor into the general COLA numbers that people are using.
What do you use for inflation rate?
In forecasting?
Yeah.
I usually use 3 to 3.5%, somewhere in that range, and somewhere the 2 to 2.5% for COLAs. And that's, of course, historic. I mean, obviously, people that remember the 70s and early 80s, it was a lot higher. And then we've had periods of time where it's zero, so.
Recently.
But over for a long period of time, that's the historic inflation average.
Okay. So for those of you listening, the higher the inflation rate, if you're using that as your spendable income, it's rising faster. And what Joe was saying, I'm going to be very cautious. I'm going to flip it around and say your earning power is going to be less than the and that's very cautious and very good.
It's cautious, and it's also not quite as severe and significant as people might think, as the 3 versus the 2. It's not like if you could retire and be comfortable if the COLA was 3 and inflation was 3, and if the COLA is only 2, you're going to run out of money. It's not quite that severe.
But it's always also a matter of like how long are you going to be retired. So if you want to retire at 50, it's a big deal if there's a COLA. But if you want to retire at 75, then maybe not so much of a deal.
Exactly. Right.
Okay. I'm going to ask you, this maybe isn't fair. When you're dealing with a client and they just can't cut their spending, what do you do with them? Other than saying I fire them.
Yeah, I was going to say, ask them to leave.
You wouldn't do that. You're
a good
guy. I mean, how do you twist their arm? And then I'm going to ask you the reverse.
Okay.
But let's do the one. Joe, I'm going to have to work till I'm 85. Tammy, what do I do?
Well, and to be honest, life's about choices. I mean, it's kind of like eating habits. You know, you make these choices, you get the results. So there are some people and it's totally okay to say, I want to live a certain lifestyle and it's going to require me to work more. There is one sort of way that we explore that I think is an out for some folks, is that is to retire from the government at eligibility and go into the private sector, to where now you've got that retirement check and your money coming in from your new job. And if you can pull that off, maybe it shortens the working till 85, because now you've got the extra money coming from your annuity. Of course, you have to save
it.
That's the trick.
Don't expand your lifestyle.
But if you can do that, for a lot of people, that's sort of, I won't call it like a second chance or a sort of a break glass in case of emergency plan. But it is a way that people who have more expensive lifestyles can save enough in a hurry up way for retirement.
Okay, let's do the reverse. I didn't know I was that well off. I can go out and buy the car and travel and things like that.
Most people don't do that, though. If somebody's really spending that little and is that conservative and
they're
could have spent
change.
More, they're not. I have these meetings all the time. They're not going to, you know, shake my hand and run out the door and go to the Mercedes dealership. You know, but it does though show that you've got the flexibility to do whatever it is you want. And the one thing I find those people really appreciate is that if you look and you really don't spend that much, you've saved very well, and I make the point you can retire right away. It's sort of a liberation that you can do whatever you want the rest of your life, regardless of financial reasons.
It's sense of security. It's a sense of relief to know that, hey, it's better than I thought.
If you want to keep working, you can. I mean, a lot of people say once they find out they can afford to retire, their job gets a lot more enjoyable.
Okay. All right. So we've covered meeting with somebody, or at least realizing that they need to do the analysis and the like. Now, what about some of the noise in the news? I won't call it noise. I mean, like, I think we all agree that tax rates are going to go up, but probably they're going to go up for the individuals that make more than what we do.
Maybe. I mean, the $250,000 threshold, I think, probably affects some dual income federal employees. But in general, you know, I had a client in my office just the other day, and we were looking at this, and he wanted to know, as a couple, they both are federal. They made I think they made right at 250, and they were concerned about the fiscal cliff. So I got out the tax brackets and laid it on the table. And I'm sure you've done this as a tax person, where you show people the marginal tax brackets, the fact that if you're married, first $17,400 or whatever it is taxed at 10% and on and up. So I showed them the bracket that they want to affect is the 33% and 35%, which they want to, all the rhetoric is to go to, I think, 36% and 39.6%. So the 33% bracket starts at about 217 for a married couple.
It's what you make above that level.
It's what you make above that.
It's taxable.
Yeah, and
taxable. The tax after all your deductions.
Before you,
after all the deductions, exactly. So
which may not
even if the deductions didn't bring it down, we were talking about a 3% increase on $33,000, or about $900. Well, you could just see the exhale, the sort of the rhetoric and the way this is being used politically in the media, my goodness, is creating this scene that all of a sudden next year, you know,
we're all going to
double our taxes. Yeah. And it just isn't true.
Some of the underlying income, it depends if we fall off the cliff and we go to the pre-Bush tax, or we go to the one that seems to be in the lead right now. Mm-hmm. They have other taxes on top of it, regardless of which ones we do. For example, investment income, if the one side wins, if you will, dividend income is taxed very lightly now. It won't be under the – and then the, quote, Medicare tax on top of it
Even the change in the FICA tax.
Yeah.
And I think it's fair to also add that if we, quote unquote, go off the cliff, it won't be just those top brackets that go up. It'll be all of the other brackets. And
right.
that is more impactful.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Everyone mm-hmm. gets clipped with that.
But it does seem like both sides, at least, that's one factor that they agree on, is that those brackets down below the 217 for married and wherever you may know the cutoff for single people, wherever it is below that, that those brackets will most likely stay where they are.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's pretty rough if it goes back to...
That's
to
the severe impact.
Yeah. And again, that would be everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And not by a little.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And in states, who knows what the states are going to do, because they're as bad off or worse than the feds. And they keep... I live in Maryland. Maryland is not enjoying its finest financial times. And there's just a tax here. There's tax there. We've got a bag tax.
Bag tax.
Yeah, we have to pay a nickel if we use one of the grocery bags. So, you know, people bring in their pillowcases and they put it in. I mean, it looks like pillowcases, but anyway. So, don't they?
It'll all be solved by your new casino. Yeah. Huh? You're okay.
Yeah. All righty. So, Tammy, Joe and I have been talking about dollars, you too, but with the Social Security, you mentioned those books. What would you suggest people, because I think don't you think it's a great unknown, the entitlement to Social Security and when to take it and whatnot? And I know you teach it. I know I don't.
Well, I think it's something people think about, but not everybody has a choice of when to take it. Because let's say, for instance, you retire under FERS when you're 57. And you're going to get your FERS benefits, you're going to get the supplement, and the FERS supplement ends at 62. So if you didn't have a plan for what you're going to do, then you're going to be kind of forced into taking Social Security at 62 to make up that difference. So I think, like Joe said, the key is in planning ahead to know, like, okay, this is going to be for the next 5 years, I get a supplement, then what do I do? Am I going to take money from my thrift plan more? Am I going to work part-time? You know, how do I handle that? So I think if you have a plan and you understand things, I think the key is understanding what you have. I think a lot of folks just don't have that basic understanding of how these three parts work together. And the three parts being your government pension, FERS, FERS or CSRS, the thrift savings plan, which is a pile of money. It's how mm-hmm. I look at it, just a bunch of money. And then your Social Security benefit. So once you understand how those three work, then you can start making a plan to figure out when's the best time to take which one of them.
Okay, we have somebody on the phone that's got a plan to talk to you. Good morning.
Yeah, I think what Tammy said a little while ago kind of woke me up on this Monday morning.
Good.
In any case, what did you say, Tammy, about if you take the Social Security at age 70, the difference is really huge?
It is. It is. They have what they call delayed retirement credits, which is kind of Social Security's way of saying, let's make a deal. So if you don't take your benefit at your full retirement age, which for somebody born in 1950 is 62 or 66.
Yeah.
So for somebody who's 62 this year, if they wait till they're 66, 4 years from now, that's their full benefit age. That's 100% of what they're entitled to. But if they wait till they're 70, that's an 8% per year increase for waiting, even if you're not adding anything to your Social Security records. That's 32% more. But this only makes sense if you live past age 80.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, if you're only going to collect it for 7 years, you know, you might as well take it the sooner the better.
So is the age 70 like that for anybody?
Yep.
Or is it? Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody who delays their benefit can take advantage of those credits.
Wow.
And of course, if you work until 70, then you're going to add to your average wages as well. So there's two benefits there.
All right.
And
I was not sleeping after all.
No, you were listening very well. Thanks for calling in.
But Tammy's commission will take it back. Just kidding.
No.
Tammy would never do that. Just kidding.
Anyway, none.
Thanks for calling. And anybody else that wants to call us, we still have some time. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Do you find one of the toughest things you talk about is the Social Security, your entitlement, and how it works?
Yeah, that's one of them. That's certainly one that we get a lot of questions about, that and Medicare. You know, everybody doesn't understand, like, why do we need Medicare if we have lifetime health insurance? But that's for another show, because that could take a full hour. But yeah, those are Social Security programs in general do create a lot of confusion, because we've never collected a Social Security check before. So now we have to add that into our knowledge base.
Well, and one factor on the financial planning side, I would add, if you do or if you're making the decision between keeping taking Social Security at 66 versus 70, is the opportunity cost of what you would replace it with. If you
need that income,
replace that money, sure, at the end of the day, if you live long enough, you might get more out of the system. But you also, by taking it sooner, get the money sooner. And and even if you are using it, you're not withdrawing from your TSP or some other place.
Well, here's a question I have for you that comes up. Let's say I'm 66. I'm at the full benefit age where there's no longer an earnings test, and I'm still working. I like what I do. I don't want to retire yet. I'm going to work till I'm 70, speaking of somebody here in this room who might do the same thing. So this might be, listen up, Bob.
I don't know who that would be.
So let's say I'm going to keep working till I'm 70, regardless. But I could take my Social Security benefit now and still work because there's no earnings limit. Or I could wait and pick up those credits when I do retire at age 70. Would you suggest I take it and bank it, or would
I think
you
if you're still working, it makes sense to probably delay.
Wait.
Just because you don't need it right away. You're going to have that money, you know, even though it's very tax efficient. What are you going to do with the money afterwards? I like the idea what you said with the 8% increase plus the earnings thing. That's the other factor is you might end up getting more money because you're increasing your wages.
Your wages, and also if you're married, I guess that should be another consideration because if you delay your benefit, and let's say you have a spouse who doesn't have as big of an income or maybe didn't work outside the home, you're also, I hate to say this, but you're also increasing widow's benefits by doing that as well.
I think the general way I think of it, and it gets more complicated than this, but a real simple way is take it when you need it.
Right.
You know, if you don't need the income at the moment, then you can delay it.
It might make sense to delay it. That's good. That kind of matches up with what I kind of suggest.
Well, that's fortunate.
People ask that.
Good. I'm glad
Good.
I know.
You can continue to follow me in the seminars.
Excellent.
And I get the tail end. I have to give them all the bad news. Anyway. All right. So we got about, what, six minutes left? Okay. So final thoughts, 6 minutes, we can drill into this a little bit. We covered mid-career, mostly pre-retirement. But how do you get to the beginning career folks talk to you, Joe?
Mm-hmm.
Do they?
They do.
Are they engineers?
I think.
Are they getting more interested in their future than they used to
they
be?
Are. I think so. What Tammy said earlier, I think, really applies to the early career people is that, you know, that the FERS employees almost have this different perspective than the CSRS employee where they know they need to really save in the TSP. Well, I think even the younger people, even more so, it's a very cynical mindset, you know, that. Even things like we talk about Social Security, the younger people are just rolling their eyes while they're listening, thinking,
yeah, the
well,
younger
that isn't
the group, the less
me.
Confidence they have, which is probably good for them.
It
not
is.
To be,
and they feel like they have to take care of it. And if you think about it generationally, it makes sense. I mean, you go back even to people that retired in the 40s and 50s, a lot of those folks had pensions in the private sector that paid everything, you know? And so we're sort of only a couple generations into where people have to at least supplement this themselves. And I think the next 3 or 4 generations are going to be people who have to do it all themselves to some degree. And so I think that they're aware of that. And you see a lot of very encouraging things from younger people. You also, the downside for the younger crowd though, is the spending is it's difficult to get started, you know, and manage your money that way. You just have to have a budget early and a discipline to try to just save a little bit at least.
Do you find that they look for the greatest rate of return, middle rate of return, or the most cautious rate of return?
I think they tend to be more aggressive, which is where they should be because of the time frame that they have. Now, granted, there's sort of a mindset now with all the stuff in the news of pessimism, but still, you don't see that as much, I think, with the younger crowd.
And justifiably so. Mm-hmm. I wish I had thought like that a long time ago.
You always have to remember is what matters is what your TSP is worth when you retire, not what it's worth when you're 31 years old.
All right, and then just moving on up the ranks, I always do this. Mid-career folks, let's say non-married. Mid-career individual, and they're never going to be married. How do they look at things? How would you have them look at things? Cautiously.
Yeah, it's all a matter of, like I said earlier, with the fact that what you invest your money in should be related to what you need your money to do. And I think mid-career is where you start honing in on the specifics and you have a better idea. It's, you know, a 30-year-old doesn't know where they're going to retire and what their lifestyle. I mean, it's way too soon. But as you get, say, within 10 years of retirement, you start to begin to visualize the finish line and know, you know, I think I'm going to retire here. I want to have a boat. I want to do these things, you know, whatever it is. And you can start to run the math. In fact, to answer Bob, I'll tell you, Tammy actually gave me this. I don't remember the exact data, but I remember seeing a poll that she did that OPM had done, where some overwhelming percentage of federal employees felt like that they were on track for retirement. Yep. But this tiny percentage had actually done any calculations. I think that's the big problem, is you have to have a plan. I mean, it's like getting in a car and driving with no map. I mean, you've got to know where you're headed.
Okay. And then the mid-career who wants to save but can't. Mm-hmm. Could be a family issue, could be a marriage issue, could be taking care of parents. How do you help them?
If it's a temporary situation, you get through it. And I have a lot of clients in that situation where it's sort of a reverse, I don't know what, I need to come up with a term for it, like a hill, mm-hmm. where the biggest needs lie where in your 50s, you got kids in college, you have a parent you're taking care of. I mean, it's overwhelming, and you just get through that. But once all the kids are gone and you maybe don't have the elder care issues anymore, now it becomes a much easier plan. And I find people that on the back end can achieve their goals very easily. Their challenge is achieving the goals in the near term. And so I don't want to tell a couple that's that age, start cutting spending. I mean, mm-hmm. I might be taking care of mom. I mean, you're going to get rid of that. That's not what we want to do. But for
it's like driving through a snowstorm and then all
exactly
of a sudden
the like.
Sky clears.
And in fact, those people find themselves in really good shape because those expenses, when they drop, their lifestyle is much, much more affordable than.
I had a friend, it was a few years ago, called up and said, I got a raise of X. I said, how did you possibly do that? He said, no more tuition.
Right.
And
okay.
So
that's
it was
huge.
Really like then they could save some more.
That's what I tell people. When you're paying for private high school, you're practicing paying for college. You're all set.
All right. We got about a minute left, right, Andrew? Okay. Final comments, y'all?
Yeah. there's a few things I'd get into, but we'll wait till next week. I know there's maybe some employees who have questions who are retiring the end of this year. And I will say that OPM has made great strides in reducing their backlog, although I think at the end of the year they're going to get overwhelmed with cases again. So just plan for those first months of retirement to be transitional, where you might need some income from your annual leave check or maybe, kind of phase into retirement.
Okay, and on December 24th, we'll do an Evergreen show, a repeat of a prior show. On the next one, 31st, we got Mike Causey, Tammy and I looking at the year ahead, and January 7th, the Thrift Folks. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.